Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Steve Clements, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He is also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and previously served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. Welcome to Background Briefing, and Happy New Year, Steve.
Happy New Year, Ian. Great to be with you.
And you've been have a piece now out at The Atlantic, Biden Gets China, on Vice President being handed this very important portfolio, given that the Obama administration sort of have tilted towards the Pacific and away from Europe. Tell me, though, what's going on with Biden's general fate here? Because these persistent rumors are about that he will be dropped as VP and Hillary be put on the ticket to bolster Obama's re-election chances.
Well, I have no information about that. I still would be in the school of thinking that thinks it's highly unlikely. I think that from my time in the White House, I don't sense any reality to that kind of tectonic shift, but you know, you're talking about a very, very high level decision, and in my sense, it would be historic and perhaps look desperate for that kind of shift. That said, as I wrote in the piece, Joe Biden has been tasked with several foreign policy things that at the time he was given them were not, you know, high profile and not, you know, page turners in the New York Times and Post and LA Times. They were kind of behind the scenes deals. One was in the nuclear materials summit that Biden really did the background work and on getting a Russia reset and doing a lot of the real day-by-day negotiation between various parties inside Iraq. And all of these have gone from a perspective of today, they've all gone rather well. And so his deck on the foreign policy side is clear. And I asked him about a month ago what his next deal would be, and he said China. But I think that at that time, there was not yet the real shift in place that he would be seen and recognized as leading on the China portfolio, but it's since been confirmed to me. And it's interesting, and in part it makes a lot of sense because China's vice premier, who is likely to be the next premier of China, is one that is at a different level and footing than Tim Geithner and Hillary Clinton. So Biden getting this role is something that makes a lot of sense structurally.
So are you talking about a vice president to vice president relationship?
Yeah, a vice president to a vice president who is also a president in waiting. Xi Jinping is going to ascend, by all accounts, to be China's president in 2012. And because that is widely known and widely interpreted to be the case, you know, power is a function of future expectations. And so Xi Jinping is on the rise. And thus, just having our Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of State, both very distinguished cabinet members, very high ranking, managing the China and U.S. Strategic and economic dialogue still isn't of the stature they need to basically influence and to court a relationship with the Xi Jinping. So that's where this has been tilting and why they're positioning Biden now to get this China-U.S. portfolio, which has been somewhat without direction because you do have Treasury and State both sort of co-managing it, but it seems amorphous to many folks. And I think this is a way to both elevate the stature of the China portfolio and its significance and to put somebody on it who has line responsibility to the president.
And Xi Jinping, Steve Clements, is he the generational shift that a lot of analysts have been waiting for? Most of the Chinese leaders since the revolutionary cadre of Deng Xiaoping have been Soviet-trained engineers, somewhat gray, somewhat opaque technocrats. How would you describe Xi Jinping?
Xi Jinping is a princeling, but he is considered to be a brilliant guy who isn't in his position just because of his father's stature.
His father being who?
He is someone who's been vice premier, been handling some of the toughest portfolios in China, and he's in that fifth generation group of leaders who is coming along, in this next phase. And so he is a generational shift. He is the first person who hasn't been designated by one of the Long March leaders. Both Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao were set into place by Deng Xiaoping, who is really China's modernizer, if you will, and the person who set forth this amazing Chinese economic juggernaut, and had that great line saying, you know, black cat, white cat, if they both, you know, catch mice, it doesn't matter. You know, which is basically him disavowing communism.
Right. And it's glorious to be rich,
degree,
right?
You know, set China forward. And I think Xi Jinping now is the third generation after Deng, and I think will make a very big imprint. But it also means that the leadership track that China has and the decisions it makes in this next year are going to be very complicated and potentially tough. And I think for U.S.-China relations, particularly with economic issues as convulsive as they are around the world, but also the fact that China's growth and China's stature have become such that almost any international issue, from climate change to dealing with war-torn and fragile states to big geostrategic issues elsewhere in Afghanistan, you know, you scratch beneath the surface, and China's involved in all of these. So the relationship matters a lot, and I think that Joe Biden becoming much more deeply involved in that portfolio makes a lot of sense.
So, Steve Clements, you mentioned Xi Jinping's father. Who was he?
I knew you were going to ask that. He was also a Xi, and his father was a former premier of China. But you'll have to go back and look.
Okay.
I don't have it in front of me at the moment.
But that's
but his dad was a very high-ranking leader in the Chinese government.
Thus giving this new vice premier at some point, I guess in the next year or so, will be president, right?
Yes.
Giving him the princeling title, since he's...
Well, there are a lot of princelings, and the princelings are considered to be, you know, sort of like what George W. Bush was to George H.W., that there are a princeling is someone senior ranking in the Communist Party who's descended from one of the other senior level Politburo or State Council members at the highest levels of government and the Communist Party, who have come up from the next generation, and they themselves are moving into positions of authority and prominence. And so many would say, well, that's kind of a corrupt thing. But my estimation and discussions with very candid discussions about Xi Jinping with people is he is both related to the right line of folks, but that he's also very accomplished and competent in contrast to some others in this way. So there are other princelings. It's just he happens to be the top one at the moment.
Right. And he's obviously followed the political track as opposed to becoming gloriously rich as Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah, he's definitely in the political track and has been vice premier along with Li Keqiang. Li Keqiang is, there are two vice premiers in China. Li Keqiang has been managing the China-U.S. Strategic and economic dialogue with another prominent state counselor in China named Bai Dong Guo. And the two of them have been managing the U.S.-China portfolio, but Xi Jinping has been involved on the edges of it. But he's, right now, unless there's some catastrophe or major shift, which would be extraordinary, most analysts think Xi Jinping will be the next premier. And the Chinese are treating him as such. And that's an indication that while you'll have other prominent people like Li Keqiang and others remain very significant, most people believe that Li Keqiang will succeed to Wen Jiabao's role, the premier role, as opposed to the presidency. And so we're beginning to see the outlines of who's moving into what positions fairly early, and it's kind of showing that the Chinese are getting better at identifying, who will move into what roles, and there's a lot less intrigue than there used to be in past transitions of this sort.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clements, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and previously served as Executive Director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. You mentioned a little while ago, Steve Clements, how China's role may not be as prominent, but behind the scenes, they're playing a very active role internationally. The Europeans have been trying to help them get their help to rescue the euro, which the Europeans seem, you know, almost incapable of dealing with, which I guess is a ticking bomb that we could talk about. But they played a constructive role essentially rescuing the Kyoto, didn't they, down in South Africa recently? I mean, that was...
Well, I mean, it depends on what you call, you know, salvaging. I mean, what they're doing is they're playing a role preventing complete
collapse.
Global wreckage in these issues,
right.
But I wouldn't say that they're leading the way out towards salvation and solving
these problems either.
It's sort of a middle ground. I mean, China, on one hand, is the necessary partner that one needs in many of these cases, but they're not necessarily ready to lead. And this is the dilemma for the U.S.-China relationship right now. You know, China is sitting on, you know, more than $3 trillion of currency reserves in the world. And you know, today in this world of, you know, deficit nations and, you know, economic austerity, those with money, you know, make the rules, and they're changing global gravity. And you feel this with China. I lived in China last year for about 3 months, and you could feel how the world finance ministers and foreign ministers and heads of state were coming in and out of Beijing at a rate that was dizzying compared to the fact that I live a mile from the White House in Washington. We get a lot of visitors here, but nothing like is happening today in Beijing. And so there is this anticipation that China will be powerful, but it's not completely powerful today. And I tell everybody it's like an internet startup where you look down the road at what growth will give a company down the road, and it gets a premium on its stock value. Well, China's getting a premium on its power today, even though it's only about 100th in the world in per capita income. It still has serious internal problems, and it still considers itself a poor country despite generating vast wealth today. So China has a lot of contradictions baked into it that make it, you know, I wrote a piece once, I think you and I talked about it once, called Beijing's Fragile Swagger, that it has a lot of swagger today, but it also is very, very aware of its fragility. And it makes for somewhat of a schizophrenic relationship now and then.
But Steve Clements, surely there's something wrong with this picture, though, that a poor developing country like China, where most of its people live in poverty, and it does have a tremendous disparity in wealth, not unlike the United States, why should we be living off their savings? I mean, isn't there something wrong with that picture?
Well, I've always argued, I mean, there are two ways to look at it, and there are a lot of folks that are very critical and worried about China's strategic predatory trade, and I have been one of those who've raised a lot of these questions over the years as well about my concerns. But fundamentally, you can't blame China for educating its people, moving its affairs forward, nurturing its industries. You can blame the U.S. government a lot for letting strategic industries grow, not taking care of economic policy in the way it should have, and not figuring out a way to invest in a sustainable social contract with the American worker, so that they can continue to compete in a you know, fair playing field around the world. I feel as if, you know, you've had essentially subsidized U.S. multinational firms who've built themselves off of access to this great market we have in the United States, and then offloaded and offshored so much capacity to China that it has undermined a lot of our manufacturing base and job base in the country. Do you blame China for that, or do you blame the U.S.? And in my view, I've been angry at the negligence and dereliction of duty of U.S. government officials for a long time about this subject.
Well, I think a shining example, surely, Steve Clements, is that the U.S. was the leader in solar technology, and in the Bush-Cheney, the two oil men's interregnum, China has taken over.
I would tell you, about 3.5 years ago, China produced about 5% of the world's solar panels. Today, China produces 50% of the world's solar panels, and if you include Taiwan, that is 70% of the world's solar panels. There has been a massive shift in solar production capacity worldwide to China. And of course, there's a WTO case building and a subsidy case, but that is after, you know, that is way after the fact. This was a case where President Obama came in ostensibly to build a new vital renewable energy sector that would generate how many jobs? I think it was about 5 million jobs he was talking about. I remember the New America Foundation did a study showing that there were about 75,000 certifiable green jobs in the United States at that time. So the level of you know, the green jobs deficit that the United States was running was at enormous even 3 years ago, and that the absence of a kind of central plan, of a way to, you know, look at how you partner federal resources with state resources, with private industry, with universities, and connect that to, you know, state-based manufacturing incentives and research and development incentives. If you don't have that, then the nations that do have strategic plans essentially swoop in and grab what they can. And again, the negligence is not on China's part here. It's in our own legislators and governors and members of Congress and executive branch officials. So I do think that there have been, you know, there's been case after case after case in which we have allowed ourselves and to tie ourselves in knots and not move forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He has an article at Atlantic, Biden Gets China. Just back on Biden, he was originally supposed to be the domestic policy guru, wasn't he? I mean, what happened there? He's been all over foreign policy.
When Joe Biden came in, I think one reason that his team was putting out that signal is that they didn't want Hillary Clinton and Jim Jones and Bob Gates and others who were in, you know, very senior level national security positions to think that Joe Biden, who had been chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for so many years and was such an acknowledged national security and foreign policy expert, you know, messing up their turf. And so I remember getting a call from one of his chief aides and said, Steve, remember, he was just profiled in Working Mother magazine as one of the most family-friendly senators. We have a lot of other things we're going to do and maybe focus on the domestic and reserve space for something like a Gore Chandler Myrdin Commission, something that the president cared a lot about but didn't have enough time for. Biden would take on these, you know, responsibilities on an ad hoc basis. But when you look at the line of things Biden has done, you have to basically, you know, step back and say, wow, he has handled a good number of these things without a lot of fanfare and not always, you know, the sexiest topics, and dealt with them, I think, fairly well. And I outline these in the piece today on, you know, resetting Russia and on negotiating, you know, our basically withdrawal from Iraq, but also the Iraq political scene. And essentially, you know, moving us forward in the WMD and nuclear materials summit as well, which was another very big deal to President Obama at the time, but it didn't get a lot of headlines. But each one of these were handled very, very competently. And then, of course, we had the big Afghanistan strategic review, which I didn't write about. It's one of the areas that I think Biden would have been excellent. But, of course, Biden didn't share the perspective of David Petraeus and the kind of prevailing view in the White House. We know that Biden was the cautionary force that basically said the surge is a bad idea and that doubling down U.S. forces in Afghanistan and broadening this would be a mistake. And so Biden hasn't had that portfolio, but lo and behold, he's largely turned out to be right there as well. So for the guy who wasn't supposed to have a big foreign policy footprint, in many ways he's outperformed the other members of the team on Obama's side.
Well, it does appear that they are quite determined, if that's the right word, to get out of Afghanistan. And it's curious to look at the role that the U.S. has vis-a-vis China there. China supposedly has a good relationship with Pakistan, which is certainly not the case with the U.S. They recently apparently wrapped up a lot of oil and gas leases. There's a copper mine that they've built, which I think is being protected by U.S. forces. It requires, I think, a railway line that hasn't been built yet. What's your sense of filling the strategic vacuum when the U.S. gets out? Is China really that interested in Pakistan, which is, I think, pretty much a basket case?
China is very much a non-interventionist country that sits back and waits for opportunities when they present themselves. China is a major investor in a significant copper and minerals mine, the largest in Afghanistan. It's actually a very interesting case you should look at sometime, because it's also it's a mine that's been active in various forms for thousands of years, and it's one of the great sites of mankind's archaeological history. And China is delaying the exploitation of that mine and facility and working with us and the Europeans to try to move out as much of these archaeological treasures that really haven't been dealt with or excavated. Because Afghanistan has been such a mess for 30 years. They've been in civil war essentially for 30 years, and there hasn't been the same kind of investment in that arena. So, you know, China's doing something which is, you know, applaudable and I think very important and isn't often discussed. But you know, that said, you know, China China benefits enormously by not being looked at as the bad guy that's intervening in other countries. And America's out there looked at as good guys by some and bad guys by others, certainly on the edge militarily and controversial. And, you know, there used to be this joke that America fought the Gulf War and Japan won, and now the Cold War and Japan won, and now it's America's fighting the war on terror and China's winning. So, you know, the notion that U.S. is projecting its power and capacity through what we have at the Pentagon, and China is using its economic capabilities to go out and invest in mines and, you know, build infrastructure and dams and telecommunications in Africa and Latin America and South Asia, and essentially, to some degree, whether they're corrupt arrangements or not, China is building out what will probably be the middle-class leaders of these countries, you know, 20, 30 years from now. And that's going to give it enormous political power and very deep economic stakes. That's a different model than we're following today in the United States, which is much more a Pentagon-forward, military-forward position. And to some degree, if we run into trouble, you know, with a nation like Pakistan, sure, you know, China's now looked at and has the capacity and the wealth to be considered the alternative to the United States. And that's a real problem for us. They're becoming and I think it's very clear that while we have to cooperate with China in many ways, they're also a strategic competitor with us today.
Well, in closing, Steve Clements, in that regard, the U.S. President Obama recently went to Australia where they talked about stationing 2,500 U.S. Marines in Darwin, met with the Asian nations to the south of China who appear to be somewhat nervous of China's growth. The U.S. has also showed up, surprisingly, in Burma, Myanmar. I think the Indians have been urging them to do that for some time. How much of that is a zero-sum game vis-a-vis U.S. influence versus China's influence? And how much do the peripheral nations in the South, they appear to genuinely be concerned about China's growing power?
Well, I think the fact is that China's power is growing. And so people are worried about what will that mean about the political equilibrium in the region. And those forces are meant to counter a tilt towards China. This is not about forces colliding with one another. This is about shadow games, where one nation can easily intimidate another because that nation feels weak. And so what you have is the U.S. strategically redeploying some forces. We've often talked about Okinawa, moving some forces out of Okinawa to other parts of the Asia-Pacific region, both to shore up relations geopolitically with various ASEAN countries and to show that the U.S. Believes that Asia is where the future is, and that it matters. And I think President Obama and his National Security Advisor Tom Donilon and others have made it clear that they don't want to be seen withdrawing from or distracted from Asia. And they do have the belief, and I think it's correct, that the Middle East, to some degree, has had an over-deployment of American resources in it, and it has really created an impression that America is chasing, you know, the wrong bunny. You know, growth and the economic vitality of Asia are very real and palpable and matter to American interests. And it doesn't mean you're going to secure that through security forces, but it is a symbolic gesture to show that they're there. And if you really talk to the Chinese are going to, you know, raise a ruckus about, you know, moves that they think are designed to contain them. And there is a paranoia. But on the other level, China realizes that the region is also made more stable for its own growth. China wants to have largely the status quo continue for a very long period of time. It has grown and benefited enormously from geostrategic stability. And I don't think that China has any intention of trying to rock that situation in Asia much, that it is so focused on trying to urbanize another 300 million people, which itself will create its own global disruptions of trying to take 300 million people out of poverty and bring them into a global middle class. That's going to create a lot of stress both at home and in China and around the world, because, you know, those are 300 billion more consumers, but they're also 300 billion more workers
and polluters.
And right now, there's not a lot of jobs going around for those that are you know, sort of connected. And I think that's what we're dealing with, is that there is no ability to hold everything together where it is today. Things are changing. China is becoming more powerful, but the U.S. can't disentangle itself from the Asia Pacific without paying a very big price for it.
Well, Steve Clemens, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemens, who's the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a Senior Fellow and Founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. Previously, he served as Executive Director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still Director. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The headline written down.